Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We are delighted to have with us now the great American novelist, John Irving. You know him from The Cider House Rules, A Prayer for Owen Meany, The World According to Garp, and other books. His brand new one is In One Person, told through the eyes of Billy Abbott, a bisexual man of about 60, largely looking back on his life in New York at the height of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. It's about a lot more than that, too. And John Irving, it's an honor to have you on your show, on this show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
We talk so much in this country about gays and straights. Do you feel that people who are bisexual don't get written about enough?
I think the same instinct motivating me to make Billy a bisexual man was why I chose, in the case of The Cider House Rules, to make it a historical novel, to set my so-called abortion novel back in the 30s and 40s, to take some distance between that novel and the current raging debates. By choosing a bisexual, I felt pretty sure that I was picking a sexual outsider, a sexual misfit who would be distrusted by gays and straights alike, and so I could emphasize the solitariness of the degree to which he is sensitive to intolerance for sexual difference.
You've said that the bisexual men you have known are not conflicted, and the oldest and youngest bisexual men you know are among the most confident men you've ever known. Do you think there's a relationship between their sexual orientation and their age and their confidence?
I think you have to be self-confident when you don't engender the greatest amount of trust in other people. In other words, the more of a sexual minority you're made to feel in order to accept yourself sexually, the more assertive you have to be, the more you have to believe in yourself.
And the idea of bisexuals and conflictedness, you mean there's an assumption that they are waiting to land on one side of the fence or the other?
Yeah, that's other people's assumptions. In my experience from the guys I've known, at least by the time I knew them, there was no more visible conflict.
Billy goes through life in this book, in your phrase, having crushes on the wrong people. And I think anyone gay, straight, or bi has probably had that feeling about some of their own dysfunctional romances. Can you give me maybe two examples of Billy's crushes on the wrong people? Tell those stories a little bit.
Well, Billy is originally drawn to older women and to attractive men and boys of his own age. And this is actually more confusing to him than it is to the reader. I like those situations where we in the audience, we the reader, know more about our main character than the poor character himself knows. The character is still finding out about himself, but the reader, for example, is more aware sooner of Billy's bisexuality than Billy is, just as Billy's crush on the older woman who is the small-town librarian, it becomes, I think, evident to the reader long before Billy knows it that she's a transgender woman. And not a woman at all.
And does something tie these crushes on the wrong people together for Billy Abbott, and that's part of what you're trying to say? Or is the randomness of attraction more the point?
I think the mutability, both of gender and of sexual desire, is something that always interested me. Billy has lots of ancestors in my earlier novels. I find it ironic today that we're still struggling with our tolerance for sexual differences. When you think of it, sexual mutability and mutability of gender was a whole lot more familiar to Shakespeare. Shakespeare seemed more at ease with it than we are.
John Irving, the novelist, his new book is called In One Person. He will be doing a reading at the 92nd Street Y, Sunday night, by the way, Yeah, you say it. He recalls he has ancestors in your earlier books. You've written characters who've engaged in incest, bestiality, all kinds of things we consider highly sexually deviant. And you do it without necessarily portraying these people as evil. Why do you explore this terrain so much? What captures you about it?
I think all writers feel to some degree that we are outsiders. And so for me, the attraction to sexual misfits or sexual outsiders seemed rather natural. Garp's mother, Jenny Fields, has sex once with a comatose man, and she stops for life. That's it for her. She's not interested in repeating the experience. Dr. Larch, the abortionist in the Cider House Rules, also has sex only once. In his case with the prostitute, that's it for him too. The narrator of A Prayer for Owen Meany, who is called behind his back a non-practicing homosexual, never has sex at all. Frankly, it's a whole lot easier for me to imagine Billy as a bisexual wanting to have sex with men and women than it is for me to imagine someone who doesn't want to have sex at all.
Were you moved and impressed by President Obama endorsing legal gay marriage this week, or something less than moved and impressed?
I was both moved and impressed, but also I've been exasperated, to tell you the truth, at how slowly the president has evolved, as he put it at one time, to this position. I'm glad he had. And I'm grateful to the vice president for perhaps prodding that issue along. I don't think Joe Biden should apologize for having said what he said earlier. Good for him.
You're not a New Yorker, but you lived here from 81 to 86, I understand, which was the time when the AIDS crisis, New York's Black Death, was exploding. You revisit those years in this book. Why now? As a politically engaged writer, people might have expected you to deal with themes more immediately contemporary.
Well, I think anyone who knows me and my work knows that I don't do things immediately. I take a long look back. A Prayer for Owen Meany, my Vietnam novel, was published in 1989. That's quite a while after the end of the war in 75. I like the advantage of hindsight. I like writing through a telescopic lens. A part of the reason for that is that I build my novels, which are plot-oriented, from a predetermined ending to a beginning. There is always a kind of collision coming, and the reader usually sees what it is. In this case, you're listening to the story of a bisexual guy growing up in the 50s and 60s. You know the AIDS epidemic is waiting for him and for some of his friends. You know what's coming. You know what's in his horizon. He doesn't see it coming, but you, the reader, do. There's always the positioning of a collision course in my novels. In this case, it was AIDS. In Ciderhouse's case, we know the boy who grew up in the orphanage wants nothing to do with abortion, but we also know he's been taught how to do it. Of course, he's going to be in a situation where he's going to have to do it.
Yes. And you mentioned that process of yours, which includes writing the very end of the novel first, just the last few paragraphs or so, as I've read it put. And when you can do that, you've got a book in you. How accurate is that?
That is accurate. The truth is, though, I would not have called it myself a process or a method for the writing of my first four or five books. I just thought that, I seem to get endings first. I guess that's just me, and maybe it'll change. And the truth is that if it ever did change, while I was writing my way toward one of these predetermined endings, if I ever did think, I know a better ending, I wouldn't hesitate to take it. This is a process. It's not a religion, right?
And so what do you do next when you have an ending? Do you write the lead? Do you write an outline?
I make a kind of roadmap in reverse. I move backward from what I know happens at the end of a story, the aftermath of a story, what has happened emotionally that has somehow made it worth happening, I work my way back to where I think the reader should enter that story. So the beginning is the last thing in the scheme of things I come to.
John Irving, the novelist, his new book, In One Person. Everyone I told about you coming on has said to me, oh, John Irving, ask him about wrestling. But I really don't know what to ask you about wrestling. So why was that your sport?
Well, I'm a small guy, and but I was always a combative kid, and I got in a lot of fights. Because I was small, I was picked on, but I fought back, and my mother actually took me to a wrestling room. She knew the coach, and she said, here, if you're going to keep getting in fights, you might occasionally want to win one. And so she led me at age 14 to that sport, to that place, and I took some comfort in it. I've actually found it very similar to writing. There's a lot of repetition in both cases. You have to be patient about doing small things, paying attention to small details over and over and over again until something that isn't natural by definition begins to feel like second nature and looks almost natural.
If football is a metaphor for war and baseball is a metaphor for trying to get home, is wrestling a metaphor for anything?
I think it's the recognition that you have to have your eye on an object that's far ahead of you. There's a lot of training and preparation that goes into a match that is generally 7 minutes long. Well, writing novels is not dissimilar. There's a lot of years that goes into something that the event of it being shown to the public is relatively small on the scale of how much time you've put into it.
You often write about writers and their role in other people's lives. This comes up in your novels. How does it come up in One Person?
Well, Billy has two concurrent desires as early as the age of 13. He wants to be a writer, and he wants to sleep with the town librarian, not necessarily in that order. These desires are concurrent for him through most of his teenage years. There was no librarian in my case. But I started wrestling, and I started writing at the age of 14. Those were my two concurrent things. And I can't really tell you why. I don't remember well enough why.
Well, how do you see your own role as a writer, playing a certain role in society?
The novels of mine, which I would describe as political, or at least at the social end of the spectrum, which would include this one, In One Person. Certainly it would include The World According to Garp, The Cider House Rules, and A Prayer for Old Meanie. Frankly, I think that's it. I think there are four of 13 that I would put in the political category as a political novel. Well, when you write that kind of novel, you're aware that you're taking the side of something, that you are being polemical, that you do believe that the novel can be a kind of advocacy. Well, if most indelibly to me, I got that from James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room.
And your other nine books, just stories you like to tell?
Well, I don't know that I call them just stories. I don't mean that they're empty of emotional or psychological impact. I hope not. But they don't have a political agenda. Mm-hmm. This novel, In One Person, like Cider House, like Ovid Meany, like Garp, it also has an agenda, no question about it.
Since we have 15 seconds left, can you sum up that agenda in 15 seconds?
Yes, I'd like to broaden our tolerance for sexual differences. It's not as broad as it ought to be.
And there we leave it with John Irving. His latest novel, just out, is called In One Person. John Irving will be reading at the 92nd Street Y on Sunday night. Thank you so much. It's been an honor to meet you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend, everybody.